KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. With President Trump pausing most of the tariffs he put on China, shipments that had been frozen are on the way. An American toy CEO said the trade war was putting Christmas at risk. What about now? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. President Trump wants to lower drug prices. One strategy is to tie what Americans pay to lower prices charged in other countries. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. But other countries pay less because public health systems there set prices. How would that work here? Also, the story of a woman working towards a green card, but she was deported after going to an immigration office for an appointment. Now she's separated from her one-year-old daughter. The winner of this year's Tiny Desk Contest is here. It's Tuesday, May 13th. Happy birthday to this 75-year-old genius, Stevie Wonder. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is in Saudi Arabia, where he has signed several agreements with Saudi leaders. Trump says these will add up to a $600 billion investment in the U.S. The majority are more than $140 billion in arms deals involving more than a dozen U.S. firms, and billions more will involve technology investments from Google, Oracle, and others. The president is expected to sign additional agreements during the rest of his Mideast trip in Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. But NPR's Domenico Montanaro says Trump will not be visiting a longtime U.S. ally.
You know, it's pretty surprising, frankly, that he's not going to Israel while he's there, considering the war with Gaza with Israel that Trump has been trying to settle. But it does reflect some of the strain between Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for continuing to bomb Gaza.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro reporting. Chinese leader Xi Jinping has met leaders from several South American nations. He has urged them to stay united in the face of uncertainty due to American tariffs. NPR's Emily Fang reports this comes a day after the U.S. and China announced a 90-day pause on high tariffs on each other's products.
China has been deepening its economic ties with Latin America in the midst of a trade war with the U.S. Xi Jinping met with South American leaders while on a trip to Russia this month and also during an annual meeting with Latin American ministers in Beijing this week. At the meeting, China extended another $10 billion in credit to Latin American countries, and Colombia, historically a close partner of the U.S. and South America, also signed up to join China's Belt and Road Initiative, through which Beijing has financed hundreds of billions of dollars worth of infrastructure projects in sectors like energy and railroads. Emily Fang, NPR News.
Social media influencer Kim Kardashian appeared in a French courtroom today. She testified against 10 men who are accused of robbing her at gunpoint nearly a decade ago in her Paris hotel suite. As NPR's Rebecca Rossman reports, Kardashian told the court the incident left her fearing for her life.
In emotional testimony, Kardashian told the closed courtroom she had always loved Paris, saying she used to walk the streets at night, window shop, and drink hot chocolate, feeling safe. But when I came for Fashion Week in 2016, she said, everything changed. She described begging for her life as the robbers tied her up and held her at gunpoint, pleading that she was a mother. The thieves, dubbed the grandpa robbers by French media due to their age, mostly 60s and 70s, posed as police officers to gain access. They stole more than $6 million in jewelry, including the engagement ring given to Kardashian by then-husband Kanye West. Kardashian was physically unharmed, but says she still suffers emotional trauma. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down more than 160 points. This is NPR. Nearly 60 white South Africans have arrived in the U.S. President Trump has given them refugee status. He claims they face persecution, a claim South Africa denies. Meanwhile, the Episcopal Church says it will end its decades-long partnership with the U.S. It had been asked to resettle the South Africans. The church says this violates its commitment to racial justice and its ties with the Anglican Church of South Africa. Separately, the Trump administration says it's ending protections against deportation for people from Afghanistan. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem says Afghanistan's situation is improving. Critics say that Afghans in the U.S. face persecution if they return, especially if they help the U.S. against Taliban militants. New York State is lowering the minimum hiring age for prison guards from 21 years old to 18. From member station WXXI, Jung Yoon Han has more.
The state will still place some restrictions on younger guards. They can't, for example, use firearms and have to be supervised during certain tasks. State lawmakers greenlit Governor Kathy Hochul's proposal, saying it's a way to boost guard staffing levels in New York's prison system after the state fired 2,000 corrections officers in March for being on strike for nearly a month. But critics say 18 is too young to work as a corrections officer. The New York State Legislature will hold a hearing on Wednesday on the strike, as well as recent inmate deaths and beatings at the hands of prison guards. For NPR News, I'm Jung Yoon Han in Albany.
You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. A temporary trade deal between the U.S. and China has set off a scramble to bring merchandise across the Pacific Ocean while lower tariffs are in place.
No one's sure what's going to happen when the deal expires in 90 days, but a lot of importers aren't taking any chances.
NPR's Scott Horsey is with us now to tell us more about this. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Michelle.
You know, so the president's tariffs had made investors and business owners very uneasy these last several weeks. How are they reacting to, I guess we'll call it a temporary reprieve?
Well, investors were thrilled. The Dow Jones Industrial Average soared more than 1,100 points yesterday. For the importers I talked to, the reaction was more determination and a feeling that, all right, it's time to get back to work. A lot of importers had been in a holding pattern since those 145% tariffs took effect last month. Now the tariff's been cut to 30%, at least temporarily. And for Jonathan Silva, who runs a Massachusetts company making high-end board games in China, that was enough to green light 9 truckloads of games that had been parked in China to start their journey to the U.S.
We need to get product back on shelves. I think that we're really getting close to the tipping point of starting to see some shortages. But at 30%, it's not ideal. You know, there'll be slight price increases.
Silva is hoping to bring a lot more merchandise in before the Christmas season, but he's just not sure how much he'll be able to manufacture and ship before this 90-day window closes.
And why is that?
Well, think about it. A huge number of U.S. businesses rely on factories in China, and when those triple-digit tariffs took effect last month, it was like pinching off a garden hose. Now the hose is partially unkinked, and there's a lot of pent-up pressure. Bonnie Ross is a clothing importer who works with a lot of discount chains. She says they're all going to be rushing to bring in merchandise.
Now, everybody who has goods that are sitting in China that they have not put on a vessel that were ready, now it's going to be a rush because everybody wants it out in the next 90 days. What is it going to happen to the freight rates?
Shipping costs could certainly go up, and that's on top of the remaining 30% tariffs. Ross thinks those costs will be shared by factories, retailers, and, yes, in the end, consumers. Now, we did get some new cost of living information from the Labor Department this morning. So far, it's not showing a lot of fallout from the trade war. Annual inflation in April was just 2.3%. That's the lowest it's been in more than 4 years.
Were the people you talked to and the analysts you follow surprised by how much these tariffs came down, at least temporarily?
Yeah, I think the market reaction suggests this was a bigger drop in tariffs than investors had been expecting. And that's just another sign of how unpredictable the tariff landscape is under the Trump administration. That uncertainty about future tariffs also, you know, makes it hard to decide, is it worth moving a factory out of China or running the expense of building a plant in the U.S.? Board game maker Jonathan Silva says no matter what happens to tariffs, he is going to explore those options. He doesn't want the risk anymore of having all his production in China.
The past 40 days has been the hardest 40 days in all of our business's life. And I'm glad that we're going to be able to come out of it, but we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. It's very unpredictable.
Silva is still bracing for difficult months ahead, but at least now he thinks his business can survive this year, which was very much in doubt when the triple-digit tariffs were in place.
Wow, that's a lot. That's NPR Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're going to dive further into how Trump's trade policy has impacted the U.S. economy and American consumers. Diane Swonk joins me now to discuss. She's the chief economist at accounting firm KBMG US. Good morning, Diane. Thanks for being on the program.
Good morning.
So this temporary relief on tariffs in this deal with China comes after a lot of big talk about how tariffs fix things economically here in the U.S. What did you make of this deal to bring tariffs back down on Chinese imports?
Well, it was really important in the sense of we had actually had a cessation of trade, which you just heard in your piece, where people couldn't get things in. But the other issue is uncertainty. And these sort of stop-go kind of programs are the things that can make for very big policy mistakes when we think about inflation and how it affects the U.S. economy. We remember the pandemic, and it's much easier to shut factories down than ramp them back up again. And this is the same thing where all of a sudden a lot of freight shipment fees went way up in the wake of the pandemic, which was an additional cost in addition to the tariffs. So the good news is we see trade flowing again. Some of the empty store shelves are still going to be there because there's a lag in terms of getting things into the country. That said, there's a lot that's waiting on the outside to come in as soon as to take advantage of this. But the uncertainty issue is another major factor weighing on the economy. I often liken it to, you know, a broken stoplight at a busy intersection. Mm-hmm. Everyone all of a sudden slows down to a crawl to try to creep across the stoplight, not knowing which person is supposed to go next. And some opt out entirely and do a U-turn, wait for traffic to clear or the stoplight to be fixed.
In practical terms, how does that end up impacting U.S. businesses and consumers, this uncertainty?
The really hard part is not only does it's sort of a perilous and panic, which is what mm-hmm. you're hearing. There was a paralysis for 40 days where people waited for this and now a panic to get everything in. Those two things are stagflationary. And that is what the Federal Reserve is so worried about today, is that we're talking about a period where the risk of inflation is much higher. And it's not just a one-time event because of the layered nature and the unevenness with which tariffs have been applied. It is a multiple-time event that's causing these additional disruptions into the supply chain, like what we're seeing right now. And those are the things we worry about, because stagflation is not something we've seen since the 1970s. And the Federal Reserve has said, listen, we know the mistakes of the 70s, and as hard as it is, it's better to not just look through that inflation. They're still smarting from the fact they didn't raise interest rates fast enough and deal with the inflation. We're still feeling the embers of from the pandemic, and it's really important for them to prioritize holding off on additional rate cuts until they know the economy, the inflation is derailed.
Now, the president imposed tariffs across a bunch of different countries, and then we saw these countries come to negotiate. We see this deal with China, temporary deal. We saw the trade deal with the UK last week. What does that say about the administration's strategy when it comes to trade negotiations?
Well, we're It's very hard to have that many 90 negotiations in 90 days. And what we're seeing is very few actual agreements. And even the ones that are coming out have very tentative rules around them. These things usually take years. And I think it's important, you know, the rule of law and then ability to enforce it is much harder when you're not dealing in a multilateral framework. It's harder. It's just one-on-one transactional.
Diane Swonk is the chief economist at accounting firm KPMG US. Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you.
So how are businesses adjusting to these dramatic swings in President Trump's tariffs? I'm going to ask Jay Foreman. He's the CEO of Basic Fun. The company sells classic toys like Care Bears, Tonka trucks, and Lincoln Logs, about 80% of which are made in China. When we last spoke, he told us that Trump's tariffs had caused him to freeze new shipments because the 145% tariffs would basically double the retail price of most of his toys. And he's back with us. Jay, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, and good to be here.
So you got the news that Trump is going to cut the tariff back to 30% from 145%. What did you do?
Well, it was about 4:30 in the morning when I got a ping. I literally jumped out of bed, threw some water on my face, and started calling my office in Hong Kong and my factories in China to tell them, let's get going. Let's start ordering trucks to pick up at the factories and book space on container ships. And I figured, you know, in my head, you know, I'm thinking, trying to think 52,000 feet ahead, we'll just get going and everything will be rolling. And then, of course, I get into the office and my operations team says, wait a minute, it's not that easy just to turn the switch and get everybody going again. There's still a lot of processes that have to happen to really get all these orders back lined up and back in place to get going. But moving quickly and getting ready to try to be in business.
So 30% tariff tax is better than 145%, but you were telling me that it's like drinking spoiled milk instead of poison. Very vivid imagery, by the way. But right. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, we can be in business. I think that, you know, what we're feeling is that the president said everybody's got to endure, and he said everybody's got to endure some short-term pain for some long-term gain. So our feeling is that everybody in the supply chain is going to be willing to take a bit of the burden of this. So the consumer's going to pay a little bit more. The retailer's going to take a bit of a smaller margin. We'll take a little bit of a smaller margin, and the China factory will. And if everybody gets together and shares the burden, everybody will feel a little pinch, but not a huge pinch. But if the consumer and the administration and the retailers try to put this burden just on a manufacturer like myself and try to expect us to eat the entire 30% tariff, then you're going to have a lot of problems with businesses because none of us have these kind of profit margins. So this has got to be something, you know, like buying war bonds back in the day, that everybody's going to have to chip in and help out. And, you know, we'll see if this all works and the jury's out, and it'll come in November 26th, and we'll see whether this policy was right or wrong.
But you were really worried that you might actually not have anything to sell at Christmas, which, frankly, let's just be honest, would have shut you down, right?
Oh, for sure. 145% would have put my business and many, many others out of the market and out of business, and a huge shortage of merchandise for the holiday season. The 30% gets things moving. You're likely to see prices increase if everybody takes their part, about 10-15%. And, you know, we would assume with the stock market, you know, staying high and unemployment staying kind of at a reasonable level, that the market will be able to absorb that and things will kind of move on, and we'll, again, see whether the president's experiment works or not.
So we only have 20 seconds left. What if he makes another U-turn? What do you do?
If he makes another U-turn, it's just chaos for everybody again. And this is where they've got to sort of settle down. We were lucky and we got the varsity team going to Switzerland to do this. This JV team is still out there working with every other market. And the president, of course, can lob a grenade into the middle of this at any time. So they've just got to settle down and move on and let people do business this year. And let's have Christmas.
That is Jay Foreman, CEO of Basic Fun. Jay, thanks so much for joining us once again. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, comedian and actor Rami Youssef on writing comedy about being the son of Egyptian immigrants and trying to figure out what it means for him to be Muslim, living in contemporary America and working in showbiz. His new animated comedy series is set before and after 9/11, and he won a Golden Globe for his role in his earlier series, Rami. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. From Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Ukraine has been profoundly changed by more than 3 years of Russia's full-scale war. With so many wounded in the country, the Ukrainian edition of Playboy is asking how beauty has changed. Its latest issue featured a photo project with five wounded female soldiers and civilians wearing Ukrainian-designed clothes. NPR's Polina Litvinova spoke to one of them.
35-year-old Olga Detlyuk is from the city of Vinnytsia in central Ukraine. She says her life is divided into two parts, before and after July 14, 2022. That's when a Russian missile hit a clinic in Vinnytsia. She was inside with her mother-in-law. The explosion broke her ribs. She partially lost her hearing and suffered severe burns to her arm. She screamed when medics tried to treat her burns. It was so painful that the whole clinic could hear me, she says. Every dressing was like they were just ripping my skin off. Her husband Yuri looked after her. I asked him if he would love me with the wounded arm, she says, and he laughed and said, "Of course I will." Yuri was in the military. A year after the missile strike, he was killed on the front line. So first the Russians mutilated my body, she says, and then they ripped out my heart. Olga fell into a depression, wore only black, and did not bother doing her hair or makeup. But she also remembered how Yuri loved her, even with her scars. To accept her body, she took part in photo shoots. That's how she ended up in the latest issue of the Ukrainian edition of Playboy as part of the project Beauty with Scar. In one image, she is wearing a black dress and looks intensely at her disfigured arm in the mirror. Scars are not shameful, she says. They show our strength. Polina Litvinova, NPR News, Kyiv.
A star is about to be born, fingers crossed. Over the past 11 years, NPR Music has conducted the Tiny Desk Contest. It's a way for unsigned musicians to get some national recognition. Winners have gone on to tour the world, write for Broadway, even win Grammys, and we are about to reveal the latest. For that, we turn to Robin Hilton. He's the host of All Songs Considered, and he's one of this year's judges. Robin, welcome.
Hey, Michelle.
Okay, so briefly, would you just talk about what judges look for in a Tiny Desk Contest submission?
First off, we got nearly 7,500 entries this year. That's a record. And we're looking for lots of things. But, you know, mostly, you know, we just want to be surprised. We want to see and hear something that makes us drop everything, locks us in. We want something that moves us, that hits us on an emotional level, something that's real and original. And, of course, you know, we want a really strong performance because at the end of the day, they do have to be able to play the Tiny Desk.
All right, let's not keep everybody in suspense. That's drum roll, please. Robin, will you do the honors?
Okay, are you ready?
Yes.
The winner for the 2025 Tiny Desk Contest, her name is Ruby Abara, and the song she sent in is called Bacanawa.
Nakatitik sila sa'kin, isang bolo sa kamay. Sa trono ko makain, sa gilid ko mga batay. Ako ang bakunawa, sa gubat naghintay. Yung inang kalikasan, ako ang hari at inay.
She's from the Bay Area near San Francisco, and she's a rapper, a spoken word artist, and she fronts this incredible band of Filipino artists. She switches up languages quite a bit. There's Tagalog and Bisaya and English.
I was born with two tongues, so I carry two guns, sharper than a Bali song blade in the sun.
This song, Bacanawa, it was inspired by the birth of Ruby Abara's first child. In fact, she was pregnant when she wrote it and when she made the video that they submitted. And the song is also inspired by this really cool Philippine mythology. Bacanawa is kind of this dragon. Some call it the moon eater. And it's believed to cause natural phenomena like rain or wind or eclipses, things like that.
Robin, I have to say, I loved it. Loved the video.
Right.
And the ending is really stunning. It's a spoken word piece. So just tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, yeah, I think that was the moment that hit us on a gut level. That was the emotional moment we were looking for. It really moved us. There's a lot of resilience and hope in what she says. And, you know, she says these are all things that she wants to pass on to her child.
My way, spoon feeder, moon eater, truth keeper. Na abay kahatlukan, wala diri, bisaya ni. Ang dila hait kaayotan awani. Ika unang bulan, revolution in me. Na ana ang bakunawa, rebirth the new moon.
That is Ruby Abara, this year's winner of the Tiny Desk Contest. If you want to hear more of that song, it's on the NPR Music website. Robin, what happens now? Like, what does a Tiny Desk winner get?
But wait, Michelle, that's not all. Yes, they're going to play the Tiny Desk. But there's also a live tour that we've got starting in June. We're going to visit a number of cities across the country. And one thing new this year is we're going to have a surprise Tiny Desk alum, artists who've played the Tiny Desk before. We're going to have one as a surprise headliner at each stop.
And Ruby Abara herself will appear on All Things Considered later today. Jealous. Robin Hilton, thank you for all the work you put into this.
Thanks, Michelle. And also thank you to all the amazing, just creative people who send in their music to us this year. It was really inspiring.
Support for NPR and the Tiny Desk Contest comes from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from Lagunitas Brewing Company, since 1993, committed to challenging the status quo and brewing innovative beer, featuring a range of craft brews and non-alcoholic options. Learn more at Lagunitas.com. Rewrite my story.
This is NPR News.
There's new data from the Social Security Administration on the most popular baby names in America. And to all the Liams and Olivias out there, watch your backs. There's another name rising in popularity, especially in red states. Welcome, Oakley.
Oak can be used as a metaphor for God's people planted by him to display his glory.
I'm Elsa Chang. That story on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump's announcing $600 billion in U.S. business deals with Saudi Arabia, the first leg of his Middle East trip. The White House says negotiations resulted in $142 billion in arms deals from more than a dozen U.S. firms, partnerships on AI data centers, gas turbines from GE, and $80 billion in tech investments involving Saudi and U.S. companies, including Google, Oracle, Salesforce, and Uber. Trump's also expected to visit Qatar and the UAE, but not Israel, which publicly credited President Trump for securing the release yesterday of an Israeli-American hostage held by Gaza's Hamas. Now that the U.S. and China have agreed to a 90-day reprieve in their trade war, U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer details the goal of Trump's global tariffs.
We're dealing with all of these countries in an effort to get the deficit down, or at least create conditions that will lead to that.
Greer on CNBC's Squawk Box. Inflation's cooled for a third straight month. Consumer prices in April were 2.3% higher than they were a year earlier. Prices increase at a slower pace than what the U.S. economy experienced in March. Some economists have warned, though, that the prices people pay for things like food, clothes, and other items may not fully bear the impact of President Trump's tariffs on imported goods until June or July. The Dow is down 152 points. This is NPR News. Ukraine-Russia peace talks may take place this week. Turkey is expected to host. However, it remains to be seen if Russian President Vladimir Putin will show up or send negotiators. Today, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he expects Putin to be there if he's serious about halting the conflict. Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than 3 years ago. Before he returned to office, President Trump expressed confidence about mediating a peace deal. So far, that has proven elusive. Police in London have arrested a suspect in a case of suspected arson targeting a house where the British Prime Minister used to live. No one was injured in the fire. They suspect the suspect remains in custody. More from NPR's Lauren Frayer.
The London Fire Brigade says the only damage was to the doorway of Prime Minister Keir Starmer's old house in North London, where he lived before moving into 10 Downing Street last summer. The property is believed to be rented out since then. Police say they're holding the suspect, a 21-year-old man, on suspicion of arson with intent to endanger life. And they're investigating whether he's linked to two other fires in a car and another property associated with Starmer. No one was injured in any of the incidents. Counter-terrorism officials are leading the investigation, though, in what police call a precaution because it involves such a high-profile figure. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, London.
The Dow is down 142 points. The Nasdaq is up nearly 300 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. NatGeoExpeditions.com/cruises. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The Trump administration is once again taking aim at the high prices Americans pay for prescription drugs. The president signed an executive order Monday that he says would get prices in line with what other high-income countries pay. But there's a tension within that order. NPR pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin reports.
Americans generally pay more for name-brand prescription medications than people in other countries, and whether they vote red or blue, they don't like it. The Trump administration wants to lower U.S. drug prices by tying them to those paid elsewhere. It's called most favored nation pricing. Here's President Trump talking about it in the White House.
Whoever is paying
the lowest price, we will look at that price and we will say that's the price we're going to pay.
But he also wants other countries to pay more for their drugs so that Americans aren't subsidizing drug development for the rest of the world. Other countries mostly pay less than the U.S. because they have government health systems that set drug prices. By and large, the United States doesn't set prices, so the drug companies can see what the market here will bear. Juliette Kubansky, a Medicare drug pricing expert at the nonpartisan research group KFF, says it's not yet clear how the Trump administration will implement the executive order.
We certainly don't have answers to any of the important questions that we need to have answers to in order to understand the real impact of the actions that are proposed in this executive order.
The order directs the U.S. Trade Representative and Department of Commerce to take action against, quote, unreasonable and discriminatory policies that lower drug prices outside the U.S. It also directs the administration to set most favored nation price targets and share them with the drug makers within 30 days. And it also directs the Department of Health and Human Services to facilitate direct-to-consumer drug sales, bypassing health insurance at most favored nation prices. Here's Juliette Kubansky again.
This is an idea that's probably going to sound good to a lot of people, but exactly how it gets implemented will really matter.
The drug industry trade group Pharma said Americans shouldn't have to foot the bill for global innovation. And to lower costs, America is right to push other countries to pay their fair share through trade negotiations. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
The mother of a one-year-old girl was among dozens of Cubans deported from Florida last month. Like others, she was detained at an immigration office after going there for an appointment. Nancy Guan with member station WUSF reports.
Haiti Sanchez had so much to celebrate. She and her husband bought a home 3 months ago. They were raising their daughter and having family barbecues in the backyard. Sanchez was also on the way to getting her green card. But when she showed up to her appointment at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office in Tampa, she was detained. Then, within 2 days, deported to Cuba. We spoke to Sanchez over the phone. Sanchez says she told immigration officials not to separate her from her daughter. I told them, please don't do this to me, she says. But the officers didn't listen. Sanchez left her daughter with her husband. She was then bused to Miami and put on a flight with about 80 others to Cuba. When she arrived, she says she was distraught. She kept wondering, when will I see my daughter again? When will I be with my husband and my family again? Sanchez's husband, Carlos Yuniel Valle, says he's in disbelief.
No se lo entiende nadie, nadie se lo entiende.
The two met 5 years ago. Valle says he fell in love with Sanchez because she was a focused and serious person. She was the opposite of me, he says. She made me a better person. Valle is also from Cuba. He came to the U.S. over 2 decades ago through a special lottery system set up for Cuban immigrants. That's how he became a naturalized citizen. I was escaping hunger and misery, he says. Everyone is just fighting for a better future. But Sanchez's path was more complicated. She crossed the U.S.-Mexico border in 2019 and tried to claim asylum. But she was detained and issued a deportation order. Only Cuba wasn't taking back its nationals at the time, so Sanchez was freed from detention under certain conditions. She could live and work in the U.S., but still had a deportation order. She had to check in periodically with immigration officials. In the meantime, Sanchez studied and became a certified nursing assistant. She met Valle, fell in love, and got married. Valle applied for Sanchez's green card 2 years ago. They were hopeful. But then ICE officials called her to move up one of her immigration check-ins. Valle says they were suspicious, but they wanted to do things the right way, so they did what they were told. That's when they found out that ICE was enforcing her deportation order. Lawyers and advocates across the U.S. say more people are being detained at immigration appointments. Elizabeth Cannon is an immigration attorney based in Tampa.
What we're seeing now is a chaotic change wherein we aren't necessarily going to actually manage to deport criminals, and instead we are going to willy-nilly throw out nets, and it's going to hamper humanitarian decisions.
Cannon says in previous administrations, it was normal for ICE or Customs and Border Patrol to let people like Sanchez, who have no criminal history, remain in the U.S. while they waited for a decision on their green card.
What we're having now, again, is this no rhyme or reason, lack of discretion. It's terror tactics against immigrants.
ICE did not respond to multiple requests for information about this case, but the Department of Homeland Security sent a statement saying parents who are being deported have the option to leave their child in the United States with relatives. It says parents can also self-deport with the potential to return through legal means. Cannon says while Sanchez can continue the application process for her green card outside of the U.S., backlogs and immigration policies will likely add years to her possible return. Over the phone, Valle tells Sanchez to remain strong, that they're going to fight her case. Before they hang up, Sanchez calls out to her daughter. Kaylin, I love you, she says. And I miss you so much. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Guan in Tampa.
The Trump administration wants to create a universal flu vaccine that could protect people against the next pandemic. But vaccine experts point out a few puzzling aspects to the plan. It will cost $500 million at a time when the White House is cutting funding for medical research and uses technology that experts say is outdated. Hear more about it this afternoon on All Things Considered. Listen in the NPR app, on the radio, or on your smart speaker. Ask for your local station by name. This is NPR News.
As opening statements begin, we have the latest on the sex trafficking trial of Sean Diddy Combs. That's next time on Here and Now.
The latest in national politics, inspiring podcasts, and a report from your local school board meeting last week. You can hear it all in one place with the NPR app. Download it today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Faldin. Flamingos dunk their heads underwater to find food, but what's happening under the water's surface? A biologist at UC Berkeley studied how flamingos eat. He found they use their beaks to create cyclones in the water that suck up prey, and they do a little dance to drum up more food from the water's floor. It might sound fun, but don't try eating this way at home. It could get messy. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, for nearly a century supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. More at mott.org. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting books, radio, podcasts, film, television, theater, and more to bridge science and the humanities. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The trial of Sean Combs is underway in New York City.
The rapper, producer, and businessman known as Diddy faces charges that include sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy. Combs has been in custody since September. He was in court yesterday as both the prosecution and the defense laid out their opening statements to jurors.
NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento was there, too, and she's with us now. And here is where I want to let you know that we are about to discuss allegations of sexual assault, and that might be uncomfortable for some. That being said, Isabella, good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us what happened on the first official day of this trial.
It was a very busy day. The courtroom was completely packed. Combs was seated at a table with his defense team. In the time since he's been in jail, his hair has gone gray. He smiled and blew kisses at his children, who sat and watched the proceedings. And once opening arguments started, there was a lot to take in. The prosecution alleged that Combs operated his businesses as a criminal enterprise to carry out and cover up a number of crimes, including arson, bribery, and sex trafficking by coercion. They said Combs used his status and power to violently force two ex-girlfriends into a number of sexual acts they didn't want to partake in, and that he victimized his own employees through threats, kidnapping, and even sexual assault. The defense admitted that Combs has a temper and can be physical, but they argued that those ex-girlfriends were engaged in consensual yet toxic relationships that are unrelated to the 55-year-old's media, music, and fashion companies. They called the allegations a money grab.
You also heard from the prosecution's first witnesses. What did they say?
Yeah, two government witnesses took the stand. They were both asked to describe instances in which Combs allegedly behaved violently towards his ex-partner, the singer Cassie Ventura. So one revolved around a 2016 incident in a Los Angeles hotel. Many people have seen a surveillance video obtained and released by CNN last year that shows Combs kicking and dragging Ventura. The first witness was a former hotel security guard who responded to that altercation. He said Ventura had a, quote, purple eye when he arrived on the scene. Several angles of the video footage were shown in court. The second witness was a man who says he received money from Ventura in exchange for having sex with her while Combs watched. But he said he became scared and worried for his own safety and that of Ventura when he witnessed Combs attack her more than once.
So we were hearing that name quite a lot, Cassie Ventura. Mm-hmm. Is she the most important figure in the prosecution's case against Combs?
Yeah, it seems that she's very central to this case. You might remember that she filed the first prominent civil lawsuit against Combs in the fall of 2023. He denied those allegations and they settled out of court. But the behavior that she described in her lawsuit, allegations that Combs supplied her with drugs, beat her, forced her to have sex with male escorts, all of this was at the center of opening arguments. She's not the only alleged victim who will take the stand, but she's certainly the most well-known one. So we expect there will be a lot of attention on her when she does appear.
Do we know when that's going to be?
The prosecution has not released an official schedule, but it appears that she'll be in the courtroom very, very soon. She's expected to describe how she met Combs as a teenager, signed to his record label, and eventually began dating him, and how that relationship allegedly took an abusive turn. Combs' defense attorney, Tenny Garagos, argued that Sean Combs is a complicated person, but this is not a complicated case, and that he's not guilty of sex trafficking, transporting to engage in prostitution, or racketeering conspiracy.
That is NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento. Isabella, thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. December and Christmas may be months away, but Christmas tree farmers are already hard at work preparing for the season. Thousands of seasonal workers from abroad arrive each year through a federal visa program called H-2A to help harvest everything from Christmas trees to cherries and cucumbers. The farmers who hire them want to lower the minimum wages they can pay seasonal workers set by the federal government. Michigan Public's Michelle Jokish-Polo reports.
It's been nearly 2 months since two dozen workers, most from Mexico, arrived to work at Michigan's Dutchman Tree Farms, the largest Christmas tree grower in the state. They've already planted almost 3 million seeds in the greenhouse.
So about one out of every 26 homes that has a real Christmas tree in the United States came from our farm.
That's Scott Powell. He's in charge of overseeing everything from Christmas tree seed selection and orchards all the way to harvest, where he's seen a lot of changes in his region.
Growing up, you know, 30 years ago, every single high school kid trimmed Christmas trees. And it's short term, it's seasonal. And it worked really good for a lot of farmers. We're not seeing that today.
Powell says local workers for agricultural jobs are scarce, so he relies on the federal H-2A visa program to bring in temporary foreign labor. He spends about $700 per worker to bring them to the United States. Add to that housing and hourly wage increases. In Michigan, the wage rate for H-2A visa workers is over $18 an hour, and it's jumped by nearly $3 an hour since 2022. And nationwide, the rates average around $20 per hour. Chuck Connor, president of the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives, says those costs are a big barrier for farmers like Powell.
The government sets minimum wages by which you have to pay these H-2A workers in order to bring them into your region. And those minimum wages are dramatically higher than what, you know, regular wages for other workers would be here in the U.S.
For example, Michigan's minimum wage is about $12.50. And Connor says that's one reason why so many farmers hire immigrants who don't have legal status. Over the past several years, lawmakers have floated proposals aimed at reducing or freezing wages for H-2A workers, efforts that until recently have struggled to gain momentum. But that may be changing. In February, Michigan Republican Representative John Molinar introduced bipartisan legislation to temporarily freeze H-2A wage rates through the end of next year.
This legislation would allow farmers to have a reliable and legal workforce, which is a win-win for those who grow our food and for those of us who want to keep the cost of groceries down.
Back at Dutchman Tree Farm, Jesus Estrada is busy at work prepping the fields for new growth. This is his fifth year returning to Michigan, where he works from March through December.
Haciendo esto allá no hay para como para el pino, lo que es el pino eso no, pero allá lo que es el campo pues gana uno 400 pesos al día.
Estrada says back home in Mexico, he'd earn the equivalent of about $20 a day, roughly 400 pesos for field work. While he doesn't want to see wages go down, he says he'd still be willing to return even at a minimum of $15 per hour. So for him, coming to the U.S. under a temporary work visa is, as he puts it, a no-brainer. For NPR News, I'm Michelle Jokish-Polo in Grand Rapids.
More than 5 million Americans are in default on student loans. The Trump administration ended a five-year pause on repayments that began during the pandemic, so people in default have to start paying down their debt.
Mandatory repayments began last week. Charlie Wise is tracking the impact on borrowers. He is a senior vice president at TransUnion. That's one of the big three credit agencies.
They've gotten very used to their finances without having to make that payment, and now they have to make room for that additional payment every month on their student loans in their finances. And some consumers are struggling to make those payments.
We ask NPR listeners how hard it will be to make these payments. Here's what we heard from Catherine Wooten, Michael Harris, and Jay Diacastillo.
It's going to be hard to make ends meet.
I don't know what to do. I'm very anxious that they may begin garnishment soon.
I would probably have to get a second job to even be able to afford the rent.
TransUnion's Charlie Wise says borrowers will have to make tough decisions.
Consumers who are constrained are always having to make trade-offs. What can they maybe put off? Where can they economize to make things happen? And what we have typically seen is that student loans tend to fall lower in what we call the payment hierarchy compared to other types of credit products, mortgages, auto loans, credit card payments, etc.
But Jessica DiLiberto, Sean Stevens, and Amy Tibble say even tough choices didn't prepare them for their high bills.
I wasn't expecting to plan for a $1,000 student loan payment.
They were quoting me $800 a month.
Having to pay my $900 monthly payment has been really suffocating.
If you cannot repay, Wise says, the cost will be severe.
Your credit score will very likely take a hit, and in some cases a significant hit, because of that major derogatory or major negative on your credit report. And what we've seen is that the hit is actually most significant or severe to those borrowers who have very good or excellent credit scores.
So what should you do if you're behind on payments?
Reach out to your loan servicer to see if there's any types of programs that they may be eligible for. But the reality is that consumers need to find a way to make their payments if they want to preserve their credit scores, if they want to be in a position to purchase a home and take out a mortgage, or to buy a vehicle and get an affordable auto loan.
Wise says prepare for long waits on the phone and going forward.
It really starts with resuming making payments as soon as possible. Today is the best day to start. Tomorrow is the next best day. And so with time, everything on your credit report will improve if you start or resume making those payments.
So getting a full picture of what you have to pay and where you can stop spending will get you into better financial shape and boost those scores. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Early this morning, when you knocked upon my door, devil was walking side by side.